RPG Lessons Learned. When the game is over, when your players are gone, that's when lessons are learned. We're at RPGLL Podcast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, rpglpodcast@gmail.com, and check us out online at rpglessonslearned.com.
Hi, welcome to RPG Lessons Learned, the show where you can learn from our mistakes. And with me, as usual, is Tanner.
Hey, what's good? How's it going?
Tanner, I've upgraded you to as usual.
Oh, it is getting more and more usual every time.
It is as usual. So today we're talking about a dungeon that I ran for you, a dungeon that I called Festung Castell, which I meant to be kind of a funny joke because Festung was German for fort. So it was like castle, fort, castle. And I was hoping that would be like incredibly clever, but also Festung was evocative of Frankenstein. And I knew everyone has run, you know, Strahd or Ravenloft, I should say. But then Frankenstein, Castle Frankenstein, no one's done that. So I thought to run an adventure like that, but I did it in a different way.
I think you mean Castle Frankenstein's monster. I hate that distinction. People always try to be smart. The green guy with bolts on his neck, that's a Frankenstein to me. If he's chasing me down, I'm going to say, yo, Frankenstein, you know?
Yeah. Oh my God. Frankenstein chasing us. No one's going to be like the scientist.
Yeah.
So this was a new type of dungeon. We've been talking for episodes and episodes and episodes about dungeon crawls and how to run dungeon crawls and theater of the mind and attempting slideshow stuff. And this was a hex dungeon crawl, where I laid out the dungeon in hexagons to really make the space a lot more abstract and a lot easier to map. So the dungeon crawl became a hex crawl, where just like a hex crawl, you move from hex to hex. But in this case, instead of a hex being, you know, 8 square miles or 24 square miles of wilderness, or 8 miles, I guess, in diameter of wilderness, instead of that, a hex is a room.
Spoiler alert, we kind of play with that too, that a room is sort of a subjective kind of description of the space, right?
Yes. So a better way to put it would be a hex is a tactical space.
Right. As far as we know, I hate to say that we're the first people to do anything, but you and I did some research and we could not find another instance of somebody doing this like you have, right? Like this, as far as you know, this is an original idea.
I think so. I really think so. Now, it was heavily inspired by some wonderful books. Behind me on a bookshelf, I've got Neverland by Andrew Kolb, and it's an amazing hex crawl, but it doesn't do this, where each hex is a room. So yeah, I think we're the first that I've heard of. Now, if someone sends me an angry email and says they did it 10 years ago, I'd completely believe it, because it doesn't feel like a huge leap at all. I'm surprised. Very surprised that I couldn't find these all over the place.
Yeah, and the advantage to this, as we'll kind of get to, is that you can get the relative spacing and like location and what hex area you're in matters, but you don't have to get down to the minutiae of describing how many 5 feet wide this room is, how long is it, and then, oh, you were 5 feet off, and so something else doesn't fit right. You know, like we wanted this to be able to, you as the GM have a map and me as the player map, because mapping, I think we both find to be fun. And that's part of old school play that, you know, may or may not be, you know, a component of newer games.
I've tried a few games over the years with mapping, and I was a player in one in particular run by an amazing GM, my friend Martin, who I've talked about before on the show. And the mapping just completely killed the flow of the game, because I would have to stop and be like, okay, Martin, it was 20 feet across. Was it like 5 foot in from the door or like 5 foot out? Was it north or was it okay? Is this, and then I would show him the map and be like, is this right? And he's like, no. Like, it just completely stopped everything. And maybe you're listening to this at home and you're like, this guy's a moron. He can't map a dungeon on graph paper. That's so easy. If you think that, then fantastic. You belong in Mensa, and I'm sure you graduated from Harvard, because you're smarter than me. I can't do it.
Yeah.
But I had been watching this documentary, Secrets of Blackmoor. And the documentary is absurd. I cannot honestly recommend it. The voiceover is so serious as Dave Arntzen and his players. Like, the voiceover is incredibly serious. I really enjoy watching it, but I can't honestly recommend it. But they go over the importance of mapping. And I was like, mapping's never worked for me, and I wanted to make it work. And I think this made it work.
Yeah, I think you were successful for that. So the idea, so like people have done like point crawl dungeons, right? Where it's not really laid out in a grid. It's more of like, you know, you're in the ritual chamber and you circle that and there's connections and you kind of make like a spider web of locations. Like that's a thing that I've done before and is, you know, plenty of other people have done that before me as well. But what you kind of miss with that is secret passages, right? Or the idea of like there should be a room here but there isn't. And once you put it on a grid, a bigger chunkier grid, like a big hex grid, which you had 14 locations, I think I did find a secret location too. I'm like, there should be a room here, I want to do a double check here. And like that is something that you really can't do with a point crawl without, you know, I guess what we're doing is sort of midway between a very classic dungeon crawl and a point crawl, which works for us. It's got just enough texture and gaminess, but it is not minutia at all.
Yeah, it's a great way to put it, actually. It's all the ease of a point crawl, but still tied to relative positions in space. Mm-hmm. Where you can work out some of those things like, hey, there should be a room here, exactly like what you just said. So did you enjoy this? Did you enjoy this dungeon crawl?
I did. Yeah. There are the way that you had it designed. So you did something really smart, which is for this first one, you set it in a castle. And I should say, for the way that these dungeon these hex dungeons are laid out, you cannot always travel freely from one hex to another. Like you might be able to in a hex crawl, you know, if you're going overland and you're in a hex, there are six different directions you can go. But in our hex dungeons that we've done, there were sometimes walls or other impediments. Basically, you could only go a certain number of ways from a hex, right? But what you did by setting this in a castle, which was awesome, is that I already had kind of an idea of what the layout of a castle should be. And so I knew it wasn't just completely unknown exploration. I was like, oh, I want to get to the keep. The keep is probably in the center or the back. I'm like, oh, yeah, it makes sense that the stables are kind of out front by the gate and everything. So, like, all that really, really worked. I think that, like, just the exploring the dungeon part, obviously, it might be kind of reductive to say, but that stuff all worked with this kind of setup.
Awesome. And that's exactly what I wanted to achieve.
But it does, I mean, your classic dungeon crawl, you know, square grid mapping, like that works a lot better for tactical combat because then you can just have the room. You know, you described the ritual chamber, it's 40 feet by 35 feet and it's got a semicircular end. And like, once you describe that, that's your battle map, right? So whenever we had battle in this one, though, we did have to kind of revert to theater of the mind and just imagine everything happening in the scene of that hex, which yeah, worked for us, but, you know, maybe not a one-size-fits-all.
Yeah, limitations to the hex dungeon format, absolutely. Tactical combat goes out the window.
Yeah.
Unless I were to then pull out a second grid and like draw each room, which
you totally could.
You could,
but or like you could draw the space of the battle, right? Like there are things you could do to mitigate it, but it is you know, it is a drawback of the format.
And theater of the mind doesn't work for everyone. In fact, there is a gamer who I really like and follow. His name is Chris Gonerman. He wrote the Basic Fantasy role-playing game, one of my favorite systems. I'm not saying it's one of the best systems ever. Like it's not, it's very much it's very much basic D&D with a few things simplified and ascending armor class and stuff like that. But he's super nice and he's awesome. He's built a great community. I really like him. And he's put out videos about, hey, theater of the mind is not accessible for everyone. There are individuals who have, and I should have researched the name of this specific disability, who have the specific disability where they have a hard time visualizing stuff. Mm-hmm. And Oh,
yes. Sorry. I have a friend who has that, one of my very good friends. He does not have a mind's eye, which blew my mind when I learned about that.
Yeah. So Chris Gonerman will talk at length about Theater of the Mind combat. Sounds like you're being really like cool and mysterious, but it also makes your game not accessible for everyone. And that's a great point. But this is a case, I think, of Know Your Group, where both you and I are very comfortable with Theater of the Mind.
And I want to say one thing, another reason that just came to me now why Theater of the Mind works so well with us is because we're running one-on-one games. It's me as one player usually versus a couple of creatures, and that's it. If you had a table of four, five, six players, four, five, six monsters on a side, like that really, you know, every additional sort of variable you have makes it exponentially more complicated.
If I had to combine this, if I had to make it for multiple players, and I knew that one player had a hard time visualizing things or didn't have a mind's eye, I think the graph or the hex part would work great for that player. But for the room, there's this guy on YouTube, Professor Dungeon Master, runs a channel called Dungeon Craft, and he has this thing called Ultimate Dungeon Terrain, which is basically a Lazy Susan. It's a circular piece of dungeon terrain. Mm-hmm. And it has a ring on the outside, and that's, you know, far away or ranged. And it has a circle in the middle, and that's up close. And then he'll just put props on that. So it has a grid. It has, and he can just quickly assemble a room and then wipe it. And he just builds room after room after room on that Lazy Susan. And I think that's how I would adapt this game if I had a table full of players, some of whom needed a map for accessibility reasons.
Yeah. Yeah, that sounds really cool. I'd like to see that video. You should send that to me.
I will do that.
Yeah, and then obviously, it as a 2D map does, it also doesn't handle three dimensions well. I don't recall that being a huge issue in this one. The one I ran for you that we'll get to next time maybe had a little bit more three-dimensionality to it, and we can talk about that then. But in this one, it is a limitation, but the way you laid this one out, I didn't find that to be a problem at all.
Yeah, I was actually... I put this in the show notes, so behind the scenes for those of you who are listening, I put this in the show notes specifically to tease what you did in the next episode that we'll record, what you did in the next adventure, where you ran a hex dungeon for me, where as I was crafting this dungeon, that note is there for me to talk about the fact that I had a hard time being like, this is a castle. Castles have floors. No noble sleeps on the ground floor. So I felt like really kind of lame-o making a one-floor castle or a one-story castle. So that was a limitation for me, but then I think you solved it beautifully, keeping the exact same 14 room format. And that's all we'll say on that. That way we don't give away anything from next time.
Yeah. How do you think it scored on my, totally official, totally original, dungeon checklist of good things?
Well, by this point in our gaming together, before we'd even decided to record these podcasts, by the way, because I think at this point we had not yet decided to record, if I'm remembering correctly. But by this point, you had shared your dungeon checklist with me because I had run a couple of games for you. And or is this just the second one that I ran for you? Boy, I'm totally messing up our flow here, but
if only we had notes. No, you ran Awakening at the Old Well.
That's right. And I ran the Columbo game. Okay. Yep. So yeah, and Awakening at the Old Well was our first attempt to like visualize, right? So I had your checklist and Awakening at the Old Well specifically, you had the feedback for me that there weren't multiple factions. So by this point, I had heard your checklist kind of verbally. Mm-hmm. And I built this dungeon specifically to have the checklist stuff. I didn't do great at the multiple factions. I didn't have like two distinct factions. I had a bunch of like demons.
Yep.
And then I had several individual NPCs who did not make up a faction, but there were lots of people to talk to that you encountered or could encounter in the dungeon. So I did that. You like having things to talk to, things to fight. So the NPCs and the demons handle that. The demons were meant to be monsters that you wouldn't necessarily feel bad about killing. Although I never asked you this, and it's not in the show notes. Did you read the dungeon and notice that those demons would not have been hostile? They would have simply been mischievous had you not attacked them?
I did read that, and I'm not the type of player who suddenly has moral qualms about that and goes, oh no, you know, they're demons to me. You know, I think you succeeded in making them unsympathetic.
Fair enough. Perfect. But yeah, there were things to fight. There were two different secret passageways. One was in a room. It was just a secret cupboard. And the other was an actual secret room that you could figure out on the map. So there was like stuff to figure out. And then things to run from. That very much could have existed had you not solved this ritual in time, which would have let Frankenstein power up. So yeah, I was specifically trying to hit your checklist. Did that work? Did all of that contribute to your fun?
I really do think you succeeded. The only one that I would maybe give you a half point on, and this is the hardest one to do, is an item or a trap or a puzzle to interact with. Those are the hardest that I find to be the hardest things to include in a dungeon. Just like something to mess with and interact with and experiment with, you know. But you know, you did add an extra layer of there being a timer, and you kind of talk to me about that out of game too. You're like, which I thought was totally acceptable. You're like, there's kind of a timer on this one. I'm going to be keeping track of turns. You might want to, you know, get through this at a good pace. I think that's something that you said. Yep. So I kind of knew that there was something bad going to happen if we hit a timer. So it definitely, you know, that was another layer to kind of make up for other stuff. So no complaints here.
Now that you say that about something to play with, dude, it's Frankenstein. I should have had you playing with electricity. I should have had a room that you could have only opened if you connected two electric leads to like two copper knobs outside the door. Yeah. Like I should have, that it would have been so easy in Frankenstein's castle to have some cool gadget with like crazy alligator clamp electrical leads to play with.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, hindsight's 2020, and that's why we do these shows. So yeah, you
absolutely.
Know, that one is very hard to come up with. In the moment, certainly, if you don't plan for something interesting, and it's hard to plan for too. So, I mean, no shade on that one.
So let's talk about my biggest regret of this dungeon. There was some extreme content. How did you feel about that?
I was not offended, but it felt out of place. I've got a pretty kind of strong stomach for that stuff, but like, the stuff that went on in this dungeon, we don't have to get the specifics of it, but as this monster assembled its body parts, it got pretty horror movie. It got R-rated, which I'm not opposed to, but it felt like a little bit of a left turn from what our expectations were with our games beforehand, you know?
And that's why I regretted it. So It's amazing to me, like you hear stories about a dungeon master kind of going off the rails and suddenly introducing content that's like way inappropriate, and you're like, how does this happen? Like, did he not know? And then it happens to you. And here's how it happened to me, and this is not an excuse, this is just here's how it happened and what to watch out for me in the future. I was in a very Morkborg place. I've been reading a lot of Morkborg and looking at those dungeons and looking at the Scumbirther Morkborg, like hero creator. And there's a dungeon creator called like DNGN or something like that that makes dungeons. And I was in this very Morkborg place. And then I actually used the Scarlet Heroes tables. We haven't talked about Scarlet Heroes in this. And I have to just say again, though we've said it before, how much I love it. And I used Scarlet Heroes, the tables in it, to like generate some of the rooms or to give me ideas for the NPCs. Like almost all the NPCs came from Scarlet Heroes and not from Frankenstein. But there was this one prompt for this one room, quote, a hideously tormented victim of the inhabitants. And boy, I did that.
Yeah.
And how? And when you're in this Morkborg place and then you're rolling stuff for the dungeon and you get that prompt, it's just really easy to be like, oh yeah, absolutely, hideously tormented. Here's how to do that. And what I didn't do that I'm going to do in the future and have done in the future is do this stuff, like generate the dungeon, generate things randomly, write stuff down as it occurs to me, and then go back and edit yourself.
Yeah, go come back a day later, get another pair of fresh eyes on it, you know. And like I said, I have, you know, it's Halloween season now, and I have watched plenty of hideously tormented victims of the inhabitants in various movies I've seen. I just watched Friday the 13th Part 7, and there's a lot of that in there. But like, you know, that's a setting of me. I'm sitting down with some buddies. We got some popcorn. We're gonna watch a horror movie and hoot and holler at it, and I wasn't in a Morkborg mindset, you know, like you were when you were prepping the dungeon. So, you know, it was just a little bit of a mismatch of expectations, and it's not something that ruined the dungeon for me by any means. Like the mechanics and the setup of the dungeon were here, but you know, if I was a different person or a different type of person, or if I was one of five people at your table who did have objections with kind of what made it into the dungeon, that'd be a different story. But you know, we're friends and we're forgiving of each other, and I, you know, it wasn't anything malicious or harmful, or I don't think it reflected on you as a person or anything either, so it's no big.
And ironically, it's so much easier to happen too, like when gaming is a much smaller part of your overall life, and like you're prepping the dungeon in spare time and going over a room once. Mm-hmm. So I think there's something we said again for going back and purposefully editing, even if gaming's a very small part of your life. But yeah, I'm thankful that, I mean, this, if you'd been a different person, this very much could have been the end of our gaming together.
Sure. But yeah, enough of the bad stuff. I mean, you regret it in retrospect, and that's fine. We moved on, and as we've tackled more adult themes in later games, we've definitely checked in with each other beforehand, and I think that's a good thing to do. Outside of the sort of hex dungeon thing that we've definitely totally invented ourselves, was there anything else interesting that you kind of wanted to call out about this one?
Yeah, for sure. There's other lessons to learn. And rolling the dungeon, I rolled this one gem that was worth, I think, like 10,000 gold pieces. And I remember telling you, yeah, you think it's worth 10,000 gold pieces. And you were like, 10,000 gold pieces. And it wasn't until that moment where I was like, oh, yeah, that's not a good idea. But boy, your dwarf was extremely happy to have that 10,000 gold piece gem. So it turned into a bit of a Monty Hall dungeon, again, with rolling loot and not editing yourself. Your dwarf is incredibly fabulously wealthy and has no reason to ever adventure again.
Yep. I think he bought his own, Festone Castell probably down the road.
There you go. But I also screwed up. I didn't start you in the dungeon. I intended for you to role play with all my fun NPCs in the dungeon, mm-hmm. The serving girl, the fencing instructor that had been caught in that room, the old servant that had locked himself in the vault. I intended for you to interact with all of those folks, but because I started you like pretty far outside the dungeon, and I was going to like briefly have you get your mission from the people outside the dungeon telling you, yeah, we were just kicked out of this castle. We need you to go in and reconquer it for us. Boy, you talked to those people for way longer than I anticipated. And I think I covered it over. I think I made it seem like I'd prepped. I think I pulled some of my prep for the other NPCs that were in the dungeon forward and used some of it with you. Did you realize that I was like, oh no, and like trying my best to keep up?
No, not at all. I think it is better to kind of start them in the dungeon, so to speak, especially for a kind of episodic type game, which is what we do. You know, if we had a super story rich campaign that we were following these characters, I think it's okay to kind of do that stuff, you know, but for the purposes of sort of what we're interested in, which is like kind of testing out mechanics and game systems and stuff. Yeah. It probably would have been better to just start me there. It kind of reminds me of what happened in the Awakening of the Old Well. You know, just like there was the call to adventure and then I accepted it and then went in there. And it's like, if we're both going to kind of be following a script, why not just skip it and just say, yeah, you're here to play Dungeons and Dragons tonight. You're in this old well because you heard this. Boom, go.
Yeah.
You
know? I finally conquered that in the next one, but we'll in the next one that I ran, not the next episode, but the episode after that, I finally conquered that. But yeah, I watch these videos on YouTube where it's like, give them a reason. And it's like, no, don't give them a reason. Just start them out in the dungeon.
Yeah, it depends on the players too. Like I said, if you have extreme buy-in for your players and you know they're going to be great, then you can. But like, yeah, you know,
to your point, I should clarify, if you're not playing dungeon crawls, if you're playing like, then absolutely people need motivations. But if you're explicitly getting a group together to play a dungeon crawl, then in that case, start in the dungeon.
Yep.
All right. So Tanner, this to me is the real test of, do the hex dungeons make sense? Have you run a hex dungeon for anyone else?
I have. And it happened, I think, about a week or two after this, as I ran my hex dungeon for you. 14 hexes, just like Festung Castell was, but arranged in a slightly different way and with a kind of interesting twist, I think.
Oh, so in the next episode, I get to talk about what it was like being a player in my own kind of hexy dungeony idea.
Yeah. Fun. Do we have any lessons from this?
We do. Several lessons. One is this hex dungeon concept. I mean, it's not the end all be all. It's only for dungeon crawls, but it was a much smoother time exploring the dungeon. It has issues with tactics, which we covered, but much smoother time exploring the dungeon. And we covered it just a second ago. Start dungeon crawls in the dungeon. Don't start every game in the dungeon, but start dungeon crawls in the dungeon. And the final lesson learned, Tanner, I want to kind of go back and forth with you a little bit on. I just wrote here, make up your own rules. For me, I constantly learn that I have the most fun with a game when I've played it like once or twice. You don't have to play it, 85 times to master it, but I play it once or twice and get a feel for it. And then when I start like playing with the rules to suit me, that's when I have a lot of fun. So whether the hex dungeon is the best thing or not, dear listener, don't take that away. Instead, take away that here's two guys who were trying to do a better dungeon crawl and who came up with something that worked for them. And that's the lesson learned. Play with the rules. Tanner, what do you think about that? Do you play with rules like this?
I do. Historically, I've kind of been against hacking systems. I was always of the opinion that like, if you're trying to do something that the system doesn't support, there's probably a better system out there, which is true a lot of the time. Like if we were trying to create some sort of social intrigue subsystem to stick into Scarlet Heroes, maybe we should play a different game, for that type of setting. But for this, what you're really doing is you're creating, I don't even see this as being like rules hacking or anything or like house ruling. What you're doing is you're assembling a toolbox for yourself. And I think that happens in every game. If you're a good GM, like you're going to have the stuff that is on the inside of your GM screen. You might have some dungeons in a book ready to drop anywhere. You might have some NPC cards, some monster cards. That is your toolbox, and being able to create a framework to use all your tools in, like that's just smart play to me. And if you have fun doing it, do it.
People call them postmortems, evaluations, appraisals, reviews, retrospectives. We call them lessons learned, and we're sharing ours with you.